Welcome to Studio 2 on a Tuesday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Reunited.
I know.
And it feels so good.
I'm about to start saying it, yes.
I was laying the trap there to get you to sing. Welcome back from
your...
I was on vacation, you're on vacation, now we're back together.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to talk about one of the top of mind topics today on the show, which is this big presidential election coming up in November. New poll.
Yeah.
Jointly administered by the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Yes.
Looking at the race here in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Biden v. Trump, but also the other races, McCormick v. Casey. And all sorts of other questions. This crosstabs go on for days. So we're going to talk about that poll with Julia Taruso of the Philadelphia Inquirer later in this segment. Cherry.
Looking forward to that because I've seen so many articles on it just over the past day or so, just slicing and dicing this data. And, you know, we're focused on Pennsylvania, but a number of other swing states were also looked at. So just very interesting. And we do. There's a lot of polls that keep coming out, but we're just a few months out now. It's getting closer. 6 months out.
We are indeed getting closer.
Mm-hmm.
We're also unfortunately getting closer to catastrophe at the Jersey Shore.
Yes.
There's always sort of like a rolling trickle of data about sea level rise of the Jersey Shore, including some updates recently and some new proposed regulations by the state government in New Jersey to try to combat the effects of rising sea levels. So we're going to talk about the Jersey Shore, rising sea levels with an expert from Rutgers in the second segment today. If you have any questions or comments about rising sea levels and how it's going to impact the Jersey Shore, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We'd be very interested to hear from folks who live at the Jersey Shore, who vacation at the Jersey Shore, or just have opinions about what we should be doing or perhaps not doing at places that are really, really vulnerable to rising sea levels.
Yeah, and there's a number of cities in New Jersey that are on that list. So a lot to talk about here. I have to say, I hadn't really been paying attention to the rising sea levels, but doing the research for this segment, I'm like, okay, like it's time to start paying attention.
You
to
weren't
a lot
paying
of this.
Attention.
I have to say, it's so many things to pay attention
to. True.
But I think there's probably a lot of people like me. And
let's also
we'll
pay attention to some local headlines and some things happening in our region today. Cherry, why don't you start us off?
So a new report from Spotlight PA says lawmakers have received all kinds of perks from lobbyists. And this is according to recent ethics filings.
This is here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, here in Pennsylvania.
Yes. You're off the hook, New Jersey and Delaware, for this story.
This one. And the perks include trips to political conferences and other events, and they're bankrolled by certain campaign groups. And one example is some lawmakers went to Arizona. The trip was funded by Cuth. That's a UK-based mental health provider that has a state contract in Pennsylvania worth millions of dollars. While in Arizona, two state senators, they attended the Super Bowl on the dime of a millionaire insurance executive. Now, we should explain Pennsylvania's laws around this are very loose, and most lawmakers, they can accept gifts as long as they report them. And they generally have to self-police and just say, like, look, you know, if I accept these gifts, it doesn't influence my vote on any particular issues. But it was very interesting, you know, just to see some of the perks that were sort of being accepted here. But on a wider scale, the amount of perks, it wasn't a huge amount.
I think it was a little less than $30,000 in travel reimbursements for a year. You divide that over about 250 legislators between the House and the Senate. Yeah, I mean, that's a relatively small amount per person. But, you know, this is a place where people want transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Some people certainly want tighter rules in Pennsylvania to eliminate the possibility or the appearance of pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always good to get this data to shine some sunlight on it, as they did at Spotlight PA. And you can check out their reporting at spotlightpa.org. Comcast is lobbying for your attention.
Yes.
In this oh-so-divided media landscape. So we know Comcast, based here in Philadelphia. CEO Brian Roberts announced, I believe this was just earlier today, that Comcast, later this month, is going to unveil a new streaming bundle. You've heard of these bundles, right? Where you can, you're not just subscribed to Netflix anymore. You're subscribed to Netflix and this and that, all for one convenient price. It's almost like cable.
Yes, for
the digital
familiar.
Age. So this bundle that Comcast is going to roll out apparently very soon includes access to Peacock, Apple TV Plus, and Netflix. What will it cost? You're asking
That's
me,
the
Cherry,
question.
Right?
Yes.
They are not saying yet, but Brian Roberts says, quote, it will come at a vastly reduced price to anything available today. Just last week, Disney and Warner Brothers said they were going to have a bundle with Max and Disney Plus and Hulu. So bundles are apparently the wave of the future. And perhaps we need to do a show about bundles because I think we're all going to be subscribed to bundles very soon if we're not already.
And I will say I cut the cord a couple of years ago.
Congratulations.
And thank you very much. It took a lot to get out of my Comcast deal. We won't go into that. But I will
say.
Well,
we did the customer service segment last week. So,
But I will say that, you know, when you add it all up, the different streaming services, it gets pretty expensive once you start piling them
and
on.
You're paying for internet,
and then
by
you're
the
like
way.
Well, I thought this was supposed to be cheaper than cable, and then it turns out it's getting really expensive, so because you have to still have internet, so this might be more attractive to some people who have cut the cord.
Speaking of Netflix, by the way, something that caught my eye, the streaming giant will release a new series this month that has a local tie and a controversial star. So the show that's coming out later this month is called Tires.
Oh.
It's a workplace comedy set at the fictional Valley Forge Automotive Center in the Philly suburbs. The star and co-creator is a comedian by the name of Shane Gillis, who I'm thinking some of our listeners have never heard of, but some people are intimately familiar with. He himself is a Pennsylvania native. He's from Mechanicsburg, so a little outside of our region. But Gillis is probably best known at this point for being hired by Saturday Night Live in 2019 and then very quickly fired before he ever appeared on the show.
Wow, that's a claim to fame.
Well, in a sense, or infamy, depending on how you view it. He was fired because clips surfaced of him making racist and homophobic jokes. Oh. The twist is that the hiring-firing sequence kind of trampolined his career into the next stratosphere. He's become a very prominent stand-up star after that incident in 2019. And now he's got this new series on Netflix with a local tie, and he's kind of a local guy. So it's a very modern tale in the sense that, you know, the supposed consequences for his past behavior turned out to be, at least from what we can tell, beneficial to him. So I just thought I'd bring that up.
Interesting. And we'll move on to the last story.
You're just going with interesting on that one. Fair enough.
Now, while some wildlife ecologists, they're fighting to save the seals. Some of them want to save the eagles.
Go birds.
Some want to save the rats.
I want to save the rats.
The wood rats, to be exact.
Okay.
To be exact.
Because I'm so intrigued.
And now Pennsylvania is working with other states to rebuild the wood rats population. Now,
what is a wood rat?
Is a wood rat.
Okay,
I'm getting there. The Allegheny wood rat, it's a grayish-brown rodent. Mm. It looks more mouse-like than rat-like.
So it's smaller.
And it has these, it's like cute. It has greatest cinnamon-colored has big eyes and it looks very worried.
Cinnamon colored eyes?
I mean, well, no, cinnamon colored. It's a creature that's cinnamon colored.
Oh, got it.
And it has these big old eyes that just kind of look at you.
But it's in trouble.
You know, it's in trouble, yes. Apparently,
the population has gone down
because of loss of food sources to invasive species, a fatal parasite spread by raccoons, as well as increased competition for food. And the population has declined. There's been a 70% drop in the wood rat population over the past four decades. So now there's this effort to bring them back. And you would have to protect all species, including wood rats.
Never heard of a wood rat until this morning, but I'm on board. Let's save the wood rats. Pennsylvania Game Commission is involved in this effort.
The Maryland Zoo.
Mm-hmm. And the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And one of the things they're doing is they're setting up a colony, like a breeding colony, of wood rats at the Maryland Zoo, and then hopefully re-releasing them into the wild. Although they have to, it's interesting, they have to kind of refrain from having too much contact with
them. Because they get attached to humans.
Exactly. They don't. Yes. They do not want to sort of warp their sense of their wild instincts, right? So they need to be very careful with this initiative. But hopefully it will lead to a miraculous recovery of the wood rat population. Wood rats, we're Team Wood Rat now at Studio 2.
Apparently we are. Yes, Team Wood Rat. And we, you know, all, you know, I'm pro-mammal. So,
pro-mammal.
I'm very pro-mammal.
What a interesting question. Pro-mammal.
Yeah. So let's go wood rats.
Invertebrates, you don't care about them, but you're pro-mammal. Got it. How do we transition now to our newsmaker?
Just do it.
Let's just do it. Political polls are just a snapshot, but the one taken recently by the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times doesn't exactly paint a pretty picture for President Joe Biden. The poll has Biden trailing Trump by 3 to 4 percentage points here in Pennsylvania.
And this latest survey shows Biden struggling with young voters and voters of color. It's further evidence that Biden's 2020 coalition, well, it may be splintering. And to help us make sense of this data, we've got Julia Taruso, national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Julia, welcome to Studio 2. It's nice to have
you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
By the way, if you have questions about this poll or just about the race in general, you can give us a quick call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And so the Inquirer actually took part in this. Any idea why and why now? Because we do a lot of polling.
Sure.
But you know, we're 6 months out. Why now?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we collaborated with the New York Times and Siena College on this poll. Pennsylvania is such a critical state in this presidential election that you could probably find a poll of the state, you know, once a week or once every couple weeks. But we really wanted to measure what's going on in the electorate right now with kind of a closer look at Pennsylvania. We actually oversampled the Philly suburbs in this poll. And as you mentioned at the top, kind of tried to slice and dice it to figure out what's going on here specifically. The last time the New York Times and Siena College did a similar poll of Pennsylvania was back in October. That was before, you know, former President Trump's trials had started. That was kind of early on in the conflict in Gaza, so that there's a lot that's changed. And as you said, 6 months out, it's as good a time as any to kind of take the temperature again.
So where does this poll fit into the broader polling landscape in terms of the margins that you saw? Did it stand out in any way? Did it reflect other patterns? Your sense there?
Yeah, I think what we saw in this poll is what we've seen in other polls of Pennsylvania and other swing states, which, as you alluded to, is it's a tight race. You know, Trump appears to be up about 3 or 4 points, but it's within the margin of error. So, you know, we're going with tight race. But if you dig in further, you really see some warning signs for Biden. There's a clear erosion of support with him among voters 18 to 29 in the state. A group that he was winning by close to 62% in 2020. Yeah. That group is now basically split between Trump and Biden in Pennsylvania.
And I know another group that was key to the coalition was non-white voters. Can we talk about what this poll finds with regard to those voters?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a group that Biden is still winning the majority of, but Trump is doing much better with that group. We see about a quarter of non-white voters, which, you know, in Pennsylvania, we're talking about a lot of Black and Latino voters are breaking for Trump. And when you kind of look into why that is, it's reflective of a lot of the issues you see across the electorate, yeah. The economy being the big one.
Wow.
What was also really interesting to me about this particular poll is that you asked about the U.S. Senate race here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And in that race, according to this poll, at least, incumbent U.S. Senator Bob Casey, the Democrat, holds a nice little, I think, it's a 5-point edge over challenger Dave McCormick. How do you explain that in relation to the results for Biden in this same survey?
It's really interesting, right? And actually, if you look across all of the battleground states that were polled, there was a similar outcome in other Senate races where Democrats are on the ballot.
Democrats outperforming Biden time and time again.
Exactly. I think, you know, in Pennsylvania, it's a reflection of a couple of things. I think that the frustration that voters feel is very specific to Biden and for some people of Trump. You know, these are repeat candidates, yeah, that we hear in surveys. The electorate's frustrated that these are their options again. And I think some of that frustration over age, over kind of national issues that Democrats are getting blamed for, have not at this point necessarily impacted Casey in the same way.
Even though Casey, you know, as
is
as,
a known
as,
quantity, yeah.
And sort of it seems very much in lockstep with the Biden administration on most major issues. I haven't noticed any big breaks between Casey and Biden. And yet it does seem like the disillusionment is being funneled toward Biden. And as you mentioned, Trump as well.
Yeah, they're longtime political allies, both with roots in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Yeah. You know, I did talk to some strategists when the poll came out. And I think the assumption is that that gap will shrink a little bit because it is going to be very hard for Democrats to run independent of Biden at the top of the ballot. But there was also a sense that, you know, Casey is a well-known name in Pennsylvania. His father was a governor, and his challenger, Dave McCormick, despite running in 2022, the poll shows a lot of people just don't know him yet. About a third of the electorate either didn't have an opinion or didn't know who he was.
One comment from a voter that featured in the Inquirer article said, "I don't really know a lot about Bob Casey, but I haven't heard anything bad about Bob Casey." Right. Meanwhile, that same voter was very critical of the president. And so I want to talk about the issues because it seems like, according to this poll, Trump is winning. People think he'll do a better job on just about every issue except abortion.
Yeah, we saw that on the economy, which is the biggest issue for voters. Trump is favored, you know, in terms of who would handle that better. And I think it's important to note that's even true in the Philadelphia suburbs, where it's about tied between Biden and Trump on the economy in the Philadelphia suburbs. And that's an area where Biden is winning, you know, the vote. So there are people out there who are voting for Biden, but might prefer Trump, say they prefer Trump on some of the issues. And then we also polled on crime. And saw that, you know, Trump leads there, and on the war in Gaza, Trump narrowly leads Biden on that as well.
Laura did send us an email and said, just wanted to share my two cents. I don't believe polls anymore. Mm. People lie. The 2016 presidential election and 2022 midterms are just two reasons why I don't believe the polls anymore. So some people certainly have some skepticism about the polls.
I think that would be the Biden campaign's take as well.
Absolutely.
Is, you know, there's 5 months left or 6 months to go. It's a snapshot in time. But, you know, I think it is worth saying that when a lot of them say the same thing, that there might
be
something
there. It's probably capturing something. Doesn't mean it's going to be determinative. But I do want to just ask quickly, we talked about the warning signs for Biden. Are there warning signs in here for Trump?
I think there are. I think... you know, the one issue where Biden polls much better, I think we're talking 55 to 35, is abortion.
Yeah.
And one thing that will be interesting in this election is there's the issues that voters say they care about the most. And then there's the issues that wind up motivating them to go out to the polls.
Right.
And I think Democrats are really focusing on the abortion issue and hoping that it'll be a big motivator. And, you know, a group we haven't really talked about are kind of the 10% or so of voters who aren't sure what they're going to do, and the 10% of voters who currently say they're going to vote for the third party candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. There's some movability there. And if you dial into the crosstabs, you know, Trump is still highly unfavorable, as is Biden.
Yeah.
But when you have unfavorables at 55-57%, it's hard to build your coalition.
Mm. Yeah. And I got to ask you about because we had a number of people do the protest vote, refusing to vote for President Biden in the primary. We also had Republicans who did a protest vote, voting for Nikki Haley, who had already said she was no longer running. How will that protest vote, any clues on that from this poll, how will that, you know, play out in November?
Yeah, so when you look at voters who said Robert F. Kennedy is their first choice right now, again, about 10% of the electorate, which is high for a third-party candidate, the majority of those voters said it is a vote in protest of the candidates they have. So I think that is a group of voters. And by the way, it's unclear from the poll who RFK Jr. is kind of taking from.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty, it seems pretty split down the middle. So that'll be really interesting to see, and kind of a key could be a key group of voters. Again, in Pennsylvania, where things are decided on such slim margins, that's why we kind of hyperfixate on all these seemingly small groups of voters or smaller changes.
Only about 30 seconds, but what's the strategy, you think, from each campaign to try to move people here? Because people are so familiar with these candidates. Like, give us a broad sense of what the strategy might be.
Well, we've started to see what it is from Biden. I mean, yeah. He is blanketing the state in 24 field offices so far. I'm covering him in the state every other week.
Very on the ground type of strategy.
Very on the ground, trying to, I think, connect, infrastructure projects, some of what he's done with voters, and trying to make it an election about preserving democracy, preserving abortion rights. I think his challenge, which the poll also showed, is that voters say they want a change candidate.
Yep.
And even though they're repeat candidates, technically, Trump is a change candidate.
Trump is more of a change candidate, I suppose.
And yeah. I think Trump, who has virtually no kind of ground game in Pennsylvania, it says something that his numbers have stayed similar.
Yeah.
And I think he'll really focus on the economy.
Yeah.
That is Julia Taruso of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much for breaking down all the data with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And coming up, we'll talk about the Jersey Shore and what will be left of it as sea levels continue to rise. Stay with us. Lots to come.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The Jersey Shore draws tens of millions of people to its beaches every summer, and about 1.5 million more people live there year-round. But new map projections from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, show that many of these coastal communities could see a 2 to 5 foot rise in sea level by 2100.
Places like Atlantic City, Wildwood, Ocean City, Avalon, Cape May could all be partially submerged in the coming decades. Governor Phil Murphy just announced plans to protect shore communities from these rising seas, storm surges, and flooding. But can the New Jersey coastline be saved from the rising tide? Joining us to talk about sea level rise in the Garden State and globally is Rutgers University climate and sea level scientist Bob Kopp. Bob, welcome to Studio 2.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you, and we would love to invite our listeners to participate. What do you want to know about our coastal future? Should we continue to build on the Jersey Shore? Should we discourage development? Would you buy property on the coast? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Bob, we want to start the conversation by sort of laying the foundation. Sea levels are rising. How is this possible?
Yeah. So, of course, humans are warming up the planet through our greenhouse gases. We've warmed more than 1.2 degrees Celsius since around 1900. And that has a couple of consequences for sea levels, right? So as the oceans warm, they expand in volume and the oceans rise. As ice sheets and glaciers warm, they lose mass. So that also makes global average sea level rise. And then you have to add on local processes. So typically when we talk from a perspective about impacts on people, we're thinking about relative sea level rise. So that includes the sinking of the land. And here in our region, that's partially due to natural processes and partially due to the way we pull water out of the sediments for to use, so groundwater withdrawal. So overall, what does that mean? It means that in New Jersey, sea levels have risen by about 1.5 feet since 1911, compared to about 8 inches in the same time period in the global average.
So land sinking, water rising, that's a bad combination. Mm-hmm. If we did nothing, zero intervention, Bob, how much would sea levels need to rise for key points, cities along the Jersey Shore to be submerged? Like, what's the magic threshold there?
So I don't think I can give you a magic threshold, because that's not really the way this works, right? So what happens is that as the oceans rise, you see more and more frequent flooding, right? So already the sea level rise we experienced since the 1950s means that flooding that used to happen every couple years in, say, Atlantic City now happens several days a year. And if we just look at sort of a middle of the road sea level rise projection for 2050, what is basically already baked in, regardless of what we do with our emissions, you know, we expect to see that sort of high tide flooding along the shore happening 45 days, maybe even 120 days or more per year by 2050, just from what will be about 1 to 2 feet of sea level rise relative to the beginning of the century.
And I've read that this sea level rise is happening all along the East Coast, but what exactly, and I think you're touching on it, what exactly makes New Jersey different from some of the other areas along the seaboard?
Well, I mean, that it's happening all around the world. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., there are a couple of hot spots of sea level rise. The biggest one is in the western Gulf of Mexico, so like Louisiana, where you have really rapid sinking of the land. And there's also been some changes in the way the ocean flows that have given the last decade a particularly rapid rise. Along the east coast of the U.S., the fastest rates of sea level rise, again, driven primarily by the additional contribution from sinking land, is this area from basically from Virginia up through New Jersey, which has to do with both sort of a natural slow sinking of the land that's a response to the fact that there used to be a giant ice sheet to our north 20,000 years ago that pushed down on the land and caused it to curve. And then for the area of New Jersey south, right, these are what we call the coastal plain. So they're basically, you can think of the sediments as like a pile of sand, and there's water in between some of that sand. So if we suck the water up, that contributes as well.
In terms of groundwater withdrawal and the extent to which it contributes to this problem, is mm-hmm. it reversible? Can we do something to counteract the effects of groundwater withdrawal, and specifically in terms of how it allows the land to sink, or is the damage done?
Let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, that the thing you could do is reduce the rate of groundwater withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not pumping, you know, increasing the reservoir size, putting more water in. You know, maybe that could make some difference, but best to ground truth this, right? So 18 inches of sea level rise in New Jersey since 1911. 7 inches of that is due to the natural sinking of the land, this ongoing response to the end of the last ice age. About 3 inches is due to groundwater withdrawal. So you get some value out of slowing that down, but it's not a huge level for actually reversing this, right? The big signal, and actually the thing we should be most worried about, is the fact that sea level rise is accelerating because the oceans are taking up more and more heat, and the ice sheets and glaciers are melting. And both the ice sheets and the expansion of the ocean are happening at an increasingly rapid rate because we continue to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Wow. And Bob, I got to ask you, I mean, Jen has emailed and Jen says, how will the sea level rising affect getting insurance coverage at the New Jersey shore? And I'm broadening that question because, you know, how does this impact? Because in my mind, this is one of the things that it impacts. You have to deal with more flooding of your home, of your business, and that can be expensive. Could you talk about some of the impacts? And if you know anything about insurance, could you wrap mm-hmm. that in?
Yeah. So one thing to know about insurance is that flood insurance is a highly regulated market, right? Your typical homeowner's insurance policy would not account for flood-related damages. And right, and so how does this affect, say, the difficulty of getting flood insurance on the shore? Well, that really depends on policy. It's not a market process. And it's not a market process for the same reason that, you know, if we look at Florida, you know, a couple of decades ago, a lot of private insurers pulled out. If we look in California, yeah. right, you've probably read the stories about it being harder and harder to get home insurance. Well, with respect to flooding, right, that happened in the past. And now it's, well, if you have a mortgage in areas that are within the, you know, the sort of 100-year floodplain, you have to have flood insurance. And it's legally required. Not everybody does, even though it's a legal requirement, but this is really a policy-driven thing. And so the question is less the difficulty of getting insurance versus the amount of subsidies for the insurance, because historically, coastal flood insurance has been highly subsidized. And so...
Which encourages development in these very risky areas, right, Bob?
Right. It encourages development, right? And so there have been attempts to change that. Now, the challenge is, right, you make it more expensive to live in these areas. Well, there's a lot of great things about living in the on the shore. Mm-hmm. So what you do, historically what you've been doing, and we've seen this also just in the rebuilding after Sandy, is pricing out the people who've lived there for maybe many decades or generations, and you see much more gentrification, right? And in that case, it's really not so much flood insurance that's its issue, because flood insurance only covers a couple $100,000. And if you have $5 million properties, like, the people who own those really have to be taking on the risk.
The risk, yeah. Talking with Bob Kopp, Rutgers University, all about sea level rise, specifically focusing on the Jersey Shore. So let's talk about what can be done. Obviously, reduction of emissions is priority number one, but that's a global effort. Locally, mm-hmm. New Jersey, what does building resilience into the landscape look like? Or should we not be building resilience into the landscape? And should we start to retreat? I mean, how do you begin to answer that big, sticky question?
Well, I mean, the answer is it's a big, sticky question. And like all big, sticky questions, it's right not an answer I, from my perch at Rutgers, should be telling people what to do, right? What we can do is, what I can say is, we need to have fact-based discussions. We need land use planning on a multi-decadal timescales that takes into account what we do know about growing risks and what we don't know.
Can you give us an example of land use planning? Like what might that look? I'm not saying you endorse this, but what might that look like?
Well, I mean, I think let me give you one example. This is going to be the sort of the harshest edge of this example, and it's not actually a sea level rise example. But if you look at Manville, right? So on the Raritan River, right? This is a community that's experienced a bunch of repetitive flooding, most recently during Hurricane Ida. And the state sort of pushed really hard in a way that I think is prompting a lot of backlash locally, but pushed hard in the areas that have been subject to multiple repetitive flooding and said, okay, we're not going to pay for rebuilding anymore. Right. And you think, maybe that is the right solution.
So put all the risk back into the market instead of subsidizing the risk.
There's buyouts, right? So it's not just saying like, we're not going to subsidize and you're out on your own. But it is saying, okay, in certain areas, we're going to favor buyouts. Now I would say that decision might've been the right decision in Manville based on sort of economic analysis and efficiency. But I do think if you look at the reaction, what you want that to be is a decision that's a result of a deliberative community process, and not have people feeling like it's being imposed from above, right? You're never going to get a perfect approach to that, but you do really, this really does need to be a deliberative process. And I think along the shore, one thing you hear from a lot of people as well, if somebody had come by after Sandy and offered to buy me out, I would have taken it. But instead, the first people to come along offered me money to rebuild. And so I rebuilt. And once you made that investment, you're not going to move. And so you want really to also sort of be having these planning discussions at a time when we can sort of plan deliberately and not just have to react in the aftermath of a big flood.
And Bob, I got to ask you, I know there has been this big push to get new rules in place to kind of help offset the impact of climate change. And this package proposal known as the Resilient Environments and Landscapes, or REAL proposal, tell us about this. What would it do?
Yeah, so I'll give you the outlines. And I should say, right, I'm a climate and sea level scientist who's involved in broadly some of these policy discussions. So I've read the 2 to 3 page version of it. I haven't read
the thousand page
proposed rule that came out 2 days ago. But a lot of, as I've read it, and a lot of the big focus there is on disclosure. And to some extent, sort of making, so the state sort of expands the area that's regarded as being at sort of coastal flood risk from the current area, which is basically the FEMA 100-year floodplain, meaning the area that historically has had a sort of 1% chance per year of flooding, plus an additional foot for things like wave energy, mm-hmm. to add an additional 5 feet of sea level rise on top of that. So wow. 5 feet is a number, it's a pretty conservative number. Our projections are that it's likely, meaning more than a 2 in 3 chance that by 2100, assuming sort of emissions on their current trajectory, sea level rise in New Jersey will be between 2 and 5 feet. And mm-hmm. so the 5 feet.
And when you say disclosure, range. You mean that this is sort of letting people know that there is a much higher chance that they're wherever they're living or wherever they're looking to live could flood.
Yeah. So there's both. If you're in this zone, like there's certain things like on property deeds that are supposed to be reflected, and also there's some additional permitting requirements. So if I remember correctly, like there's some, like basically there permits for construction or major rebuilds have a 180-day time limit. So it becomes, it becomes somewhat more involved to get all the permits that one needs. And you have to act on those permits when you do, in case with the idea being, well, the information is changing, you don't want it to get out of date. So that's the approach that the state has taken. One of my collaborators, Carolyn Kuski, who's an economist, she's done work showing that housing markets in the U.S. across the whole country are overpriced by in excess of $100 billion in terms of not factoring into account coastal flood risk. Mm-hmm. New Jersey actually does somewhat better already compared to the national average in terms of unpriced risk. But I would expect as you get, markets work based on information.
Yeah.
So as more information gets out there, you might expect to see these effects propagate through the property markets.
Bob, there are some kind of cool, far out, technological adaptations that you see floating around out there. Like in Venice, they have this seawall contraption thing, and I'm not going to try to explain how it works, but it does help prevent flooding there. Are mm-hmm. there like scalable technological solutions that could actually work for coastal communities like those along the Jersey Shore?
So I think it depends a lot on where you are. Of course, people have been building seawalls and mm-hmm. tidal gates. Mm-hmm. For a long time, right? I mean, and for that matter, you think about the Netherlands, right? Half the country was below, is basically land that was below sea level. So groups like the Army Corps love building stuff. So there are a bunch of Army Corps studies looking at built infrastructure options. Now, I mean, the challenge for the Jersey Shore, well, there are a few things. So one, right, building seawalls makes quite a lot of economic sense if you're in somewhere where people are very densely packed. So mm-hmm. there's work going on in Manhattan right now with the East Side yeah. Coastal Resiliency Project, for instance. It becomes very difficult if you're on, say, a barrier island, mm-hmm. right? So barrier islands inherently want to move. And so if you look at any of the barrier islands on the Jersey Shore, whether that's like Long Beach Island or the area around yeah. Atlantic City, right? Those are engineered islands, mm-hmm. right? They're not natural islands. They are pinned in place by beach replenishment.
Yeah.
Right, we're already been doing this.
Yeah.
And so the question is, well, how much longer, has sea level rise increases, you have to do more beach replenishment at a faster rate. And so there's a limit to how long that strategy will work out. But, you think, can we engineer a solution out of the boat? We already have, because yeah. we have lots of houses on places that were not for engineering solutions would have already rolled out underneath them.
And Bob, we only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to ask you this question. When we hear this information, how should regular people take this information in? How should they be using this information to influence their decisions?
Yeah. So, I think people living at areas that are at risk need to look at that risk and understand, let's say you're one of the gentrifiers who buy a big new expensive house. Well, you should be factoring into account the risk, the increasing risk of being wiped out as you make your decision. For people who are been in these areas a long time, maybe it's worth thinking seriously about, well, what is it that I love about living here? How do I preserve that? And what's the best way to do that? And that might require advocating as a community. It might also, require, thinking about, well, what is the threshold at which I decide that, this becomes too costly place to live.
Yeah, have to make some real decisions.
Lots of tough decisions coming, but we are thankful for you, Bob Cobb, helping us at least put some context around those decisions. Bob, thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
Bob Cobb is a climate and sea level scientist at Rutgers University and founder of Coastal Climate Risk and Resilience Initiative. He was lead author on the 2021 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's sixth assessment report.
Yes, and coming up, we hear about the restoration of the battleship New Jersey and when we'll likely see it back on the Camden waterfront. I like how we're staying in New Jersey today. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. At the moment, Camden's waterfront is without its most famous attraction. It was national news this spring when the USS New Jersey moved for the first time in decades. Tugboats helped get the floating fortress-turned-museum back to its birthplace, the Philadelphia Navy Yard.
And that's where the ship was launched a year after Pearl Harbor, and that's where it's sitting right now. The Navy's most decorated warship is getting some long-overdue maintenance in dry dock. And while crews do work on the New Jersey's hull, the nonprofit that oversees the ship is using the extremely rare dry docking to offer a truly below-deck experience. And Studio 2's Curiosities correspondent, Matt Gillum, explains.
It's a busy and noisy day at the dry dock where the 81-year-old New Jersey is fully exposed from stem to stern. Since Easter, the ship has been out of the water as crews go over her hull with a fine-tooth comb. The first time they've had a chance to extensively check and work on everything below the waterline in more than three decades. Given the once-in-a-generation nature of the work, the Homeport Alliance for the USS New Jersey, the nonprofit that cares for the Big J and runs the museum, is offering tours beneath the ship. So, with hard hat and safety goggles on, and steel toes strapped onto the boots I was encouraged to wear, Marshall Spivak prepares to take me below.
We're here at dry dock number 3, about to head down into the dry dock. It's about 50 feet below sea level, and we're going to walk underneath the battleship New Jersey.
Spivak is the CEO of the group that oversees the ship and leads the way down the damp stairs. Only at the soggy bottom does the full size and scale of the 887-foot-long battleship truly come into focus. Propellers alone are about 3 stories tall. Standing on the mucky floor of the dry dock, the ship's presence is almost overwhelming. You feel like a goldfish alongside a whale. After craning my neck all the way back, the loud sounds coming from the crew working on the hull breaks the spell. The nonprofit's director of education, Libby Jones, explains what they're doing.
They're currently pressure washing paint off in between some of the propeller areas here. They previously pressure washed off all the mud. Now we're taking the paint off so we can paint soon.
There's a vaulted opening at the back of the boat between the 2 rudders and 4 propellers. The team has dubbed it the Holland Tunnel.
I like to think of it as a bit of the cathedral of the back of the ship here because it's this huge open space.
The arched roof of the cathedral is a practical design element, forcing water onto the pair of rudders. While Jones notes the structure, Spivak is taken by the moment.
It's surreal to actually be standing under the battleship, most decorated battleship in U.S. Navy history. This is living history at its finest.
The New Jersey's history is ever-present. Important dates in the vessel's storied career abound. In just a few days, it'll be 81 years since Rear Admiral Milo Dramel officially put the ship into service in 1943.
The Commandant is authorized to place in commission the United States ship New Jersey, the Navy Yard, Philadelphia, May 23rd. In accordance with the foregoing authority, I now direct the New Jersey be placed in commission.
That was the first of four times the vessel officially went into active duty. Over her long career, the New Jersey saw action in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Middle East. Her final recommissioning in 1982 brought another honor. Ronald Reagan presided over the ceremony, making the Big J the only battleship personally commissioned by a sitting president.
She's gray. She's had her face lifted. But she's still in the prime of life. A gallant lady, the New Jersey.
Back at the bottom of the dry dock, we're getting an up-close view of one of the most critical projects that will allow this eight-decades-old gray lady to hold on to the bloom of youth. Hundreds of anodes, think chunky metal blocks about the size of a brick, are attached to the New Jersey's hull close to the bottom. They're the canary in the coal mine when it comes to the ship's number one enemy, corrosion.
When organisms and metals in the water start attacking the ship's hull, the first thing they'll do is attack the anodes rather than the hull.
Battleship New Jersey CEO Marshall Spivak says they're updating this cathodic early detection system to bring it in line with the ship's home in the Delaware River.
We had 1,204 zinc anodes that were part of this system on the ship. We are replacing them with 600 aluminum anodes. Zinc is made for salt water. Aluminum is made for fresh water.
Just as he launches into all the science, the crew blasting the paint off the ship kicks into high gear. They're blocking the narrow alley between the boat and the wall of the dry dock. The only way around is to duck under the battleship, and it sort of freaks me out.
At this point, we have to go directly underneath the ship, so I am beneath, below, crouching under a giant battleship, and it's a little nerve-wracking knowing that this massive thing is above me, resting on some blocks. It's kind of scary.
Some 300 keel blocks are what's keeping the 45,000-ton ship above my head.
There are little wooden planks along the middle under the ship. Some like work lights are set up to provide to make sure people can see. There's people welding under here as well. So it's thoroughly active underneath this battleship.
After trekking in the dark and hitting my hard hat on the underside of the keel a few times, it's nice to emerge into the light and stand up. Now, near the front of the ship, you get a preview of what it'll look like when the work is done. The smell of paint is thick in the air, and the part of the hull that will be underwater is gleaming red, per Navy tradition.
And actually, believe it or not, that was one of the most asked questions in this entire project. Are you painting the hull red? Thankfully, we are.
Spivak smiles with satisfaction, knowing they're doing the job right. A detailed, precise job that, when you think about it, will go totally unseen.
No one's ever going to see it. That's true. But the work that's happening here will keep us floating, literally and figuratively, as a museum for the next 30 or so years.
People from around the world are traveling to the Philadelphia Navy Yard to see the soon-to-be-submerged work. Spivak says visitors from Europe and as far away as the Philippines have made the trip to catch the Big J in dry dock. The ship will be up on the blocks a little while longer, but soon it'll be anchors away and back to Camden. If everything goes to plan, the next time you'll be able to get this far below deck is the 2050s. For Studio 2, I'm Matt Gillum, under the battleship New Jersey.
And Matt's a tall guy, so him being under that battleship, he's really crouching there.
I know.
No wonder he was hitting his head over and over
again.
I'm sure
he enjoyed this because he loves ships.
He does. Let me tell you something.
He loves ships.
First segment today was about rats. Second segment was about sinking. Third segment was about ships. And so, like rats from a sinking ship, we're fleeing this episode today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer from Studio 2. At WHYY in Philadelphia, I am your pun master, Avi Wolfman-Arendt, signing off.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. See you tomorrow.